Robert Frank, and I love this quote so much, said about photography is that the eye should learn to listen before it looks. If you are not able to see the world clearly, you should wait until you understand how to see the world before you hold the seemingly inanimate object called a camera.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. Gabriel Bademozzi talks to the photographer Misan Harriman about his exhibition, The Purpose of Light.
Misan Harriman, thank you for speaking with Writer's Mosaic. That's me, Gabriel Bademozzi, at the moment. And we're going to come to your extraordinary exhibition. I understand that it's been a smash hit over the summer.
It has. I mean, there have been hundreds of people coming every day, which is, I'm being told, it's just never happened.
Well, let me basically frame for listeners something about the exhibition, which I hope they'll go to themselves. It's at Hope 93 Gallery, mm-hmm. East Castle Street, just north of Oxford Street. And it's several rooms over two floors of very large black and white photographs of protesters, demonstrators at a range of events, and I understand in a range of countries. They are placed on the wall just slightly higher than us. Mm. And when you look at them in all their vividness and clarity, you have the sense of these people as heroic.
Mm.
I think that's intentional. But I'll come to a discussion of the exhibition, and particularly of its title, The Purpose of Light, and leave that hanging as a question for the listener for a while. But I'll just ask you about one photograph. Generally, the photographs of ordinary men and women, children. But there's one of Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur or spokesperson for human rights in Palestine, in the occupied territories. Her eyes are tightly closed, and the expression of her face is of pressure, but also of determination and hope. That's quite a complex and powerful mix of human emotions that you have captured in a photograph. Can you speak to us about that photograph, taking it?
Yes, and I think before I speak about that photograph, what I will say is that not long ago, a lady came in, and she didn't know that I had this image, and she was walking, and I saw her turn, and she saw it. She walked towards it, and it was as if her knees gave way. I mean, she
trembled.
More than trembled. I mean, she was on the floor looking up at this image. And, you know, when she got onto the bench, she didn't even want to engage in a conversation.
Well, it's very much a Willy Brandt moment when he fell to his knees, the memorial for Auschwitz. It's a lot of pressure.
Speak to
us about the photo.
For me as an artist, you know, some of the things, I'm not always there, and then I get told things, but I saw this, and it was hard to process. Francesca's portrait was serendipitous in many ways, because it was days before the exhibition was due to open, and if you know how I work with print, and it, you know, it takes a while to get these images sorted. And I got a call from her team saying, you know, she would love to meet, I'm a huge fan, and she's aware of my work, and I was like, anywhere. And I always have my camera bag with me. So I didn't know whether she would want me to take her portrait or not initially. And we met in Leicester Square. She had just finished an interview, I think, with LBC. And, you know, she was very humble, saying, oh, I'm not photogenic. You know, very sweet and quite shy when I politely begged to observe her humanity with my lens. And then she said, of course. You know, and as she was settling herself and just took a deep breath and closed her eyes and relaxed in the moment, I knew the decisive moment was already there. you know, at the beginning of the shoot. And
that's a very interesting phrase, observing humanity with your lens.
Mm.
As I understand it, you came very late, relatively speaking, to photography. You've only been practicing since about 2017, which is only about 8 years.
Yeah, I'll be 48 in December, and my wife got me a camera for my 40th, so yes.
And you're self-taught?
YouTube self-taught. Yes. Yeah, I'm, you know, someone that really struggles with traditional teaching structures. So I would have really struggled in a fancy art school for photography. I know that. And there's something about, you know, a guy or a woman in their garage making a badly lit video about aperture.
All right.
Or shutter speed that I love because
okay, you're a nerd.
I'm a nerd, but also there's no sense of failure. And I think, you know, the judgment of those that are not neurotypical, that see the world differently, that process the world differently, and I'm certainly one of those, makes it hard for us to learn in the way that we need to. And I, at 40, decided that I'm going to do it my way and look for people that will help me on my journey using this thing called the internet.
So presumably you've always, not necessarily with the lens, but the lens of your mind, your eye, your imagination, been observing humanity.
Yes.
I wanted to take us back so that people get a sense of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as I understand, you hail from the southeastern oil-producing delta area of Nigeria, around the town of Warri, and that you're... paternal grandfather was an Englishman, Mr. Harriman, who worked for John Holt, the West Africa Liverpool
you
company.
You really have done your research.
That my grandfather also worked for as a cocoa farmer and produce buyer in the western region.
So they
could
have known each other.
I'm sure they probably did. So moving on, he married your paternal grandmother.
Yes.
Who was an Itsekiri woman.
Yes.
Can you tell us about her and more generally about the Itsekiri? Who are they?
Well, she was a Shekiri woman and I never knew Mama because, again, you know, I met her a few times when I was very little.
Yes.
But, you know, you have the Ijo and Shekiri people from Warri and Sapele.
Yes.
Right? And it is the inland oil-producing region. So the first oil in Nigeria is found within that region. And it's actually quite heartbreaking for me because so much of the tragedy of the wealth of our great nation, Nigeria, like many post-colonial situations, you know, has been, you know, used into a capitalist machine that the people haven't seen. And I've been on a journey, age 47, of unlearning, you know, and decolonizing my own worldview and mine through the proximity we have to information that many people didn't have a generation or two ago. And, you know, I've just finished reading Omar El-Akkad's book, One Day We Would Have All Been Against This. Have you read this book?
No, but I see that it's one of the slogans held up by a protester amongst your pictures.
It's a life-changing read.
Yes, it is.
It's third culture kid talking about neocolonialism, white supremacy, the hyper-extractive capitalist structures that we have to all exist in as the world is today, and asking the question, is the status quo okay?
So let us turn then full on to this complex, extraordinary show. Let's deal first of all with the title you gave it. What is, Miss Anne, the purpose of light?
Well, Robert Frank, and I love this quote so much, said about photography is that the eye should learn to listen before it looks. If you are not able to see the world clearly, you should wait until you understand how to see the world before you hold the seemingly inanimate object called a camera.
Yeah.
Right, a lot of young people come to me saying, oh my God, how do I get all the reach and followers? How do I become a famous photographer? I always say, put the camera down.
Yeah.
Put the camera down and ask yourself why you should hold the camera. Look at the people whose shoulders you must stand on. Look at the work of Moamin, Gordon Parks, Bruce Davidson, Eve Arnold, you know, particularly the early Blitz work of Cecil Beaton. I mean, I can name so many, you know, and these are people I was obsessed with growing up. So I didn't have a camera, but I was obsessed with filmmakers and photographers. And all I did was either go to the library, read photo books, buy photo books when I could afford them, and or watch every film that I could. Light is a central element of imagery. There is no imagery without light. And I believe that social media and algorithms and how we consume imagery has reduced the importance for a long time of what a still image can do. And I'm putting on this show to remind people, not just the emotions of what I've captured, but the importance of imagery. And that is why it's called the purpose of light. I think, as Nina Simone said, that to be an artist is to reflect the times that we live in.
Let's look at the great panoply, the great anti-war pageant that a spectator encounters going into the exhibition. It's not only anti-war. It's about the Black Lives Matter movement. It's about the justice for Grenfell, the absolutely horrific burning to death of 72 people in a tower block in London.
Biggest loss of life since the Blitz in a civilian building.
Absolutely. It's also about trans rights.
Very important community for me.
It's about the onslaught on Gaza, what I and many other people think of as a genocide going on in our time, in full view of the digital iPhone. Mm.
I get even a little emotional hearing you use those words because it's such a rare thing.
But nevertheless, these are causes that are profoundly moving and upsetting. But what we're getting are the portraits of people protesting. Amongst the photographers that you've cited as influences on your development of an eye, visual culture, is Gordon Parks, who documented the civil rights movement. And look what happened to that in the early 70s, where it petered out. What do you think is the difference between Gordon Parks' work and your work now in The Purpose of Light in our contemporary world?
Well, he's in the canon of, you know, his work is staggeringly good. Staggeringly. And you know, he did high fashion work. They never gave him a Vogue cover. They should have. He made films, and the most famous one being Shaft. But his, you know, my favorite work by him is an observation of a family called the Fontanelli family. And it's, I think, the greatest observation of what abject poverty in America is. It's a heartbreaking body of work. And I have obsessed over Gordon's work for a long, long time. I think, you know, change is gradual but seismic in each generation when it comes to whether we've moved forward. Because if you look at America today and how the African-American man and woman is able to thrive, it's always going to be an uphill struggle for the civil rights of Black people, and there's a long, long way to go, but there has been through protest. I think the next move is for this generation to recognize the power of the Black dollar and Black culture, right? and what I mean by that is that, you know, we've shaped world culture. I say we, you know, you look at the NBA, 80% Black, NFL, 80-something percent Black, the biggest musicians in the world, you know, Beyonce, Jay-Z, athletes, LeBron James. And I think, you know, there needs to be a point where those icons have the sense of, okay, I'm going to force change. I'm dedicating the rest of my life as an artist to collective liberation.
Yeah. And okay, know, that's where we are, collective liberation.
And that is what my show is about.
How did you, an English-educated, elite Nigerian who takes high society, high fashion photographs, front cover of Vogue, the first Black photographer in 104 years to get the big September issue, a chronicler of the life of royalty, Meghan and Harry and their children. How did you, this elite Nigerian British artist, activist, entrepreneur, come to a vision of collective action?
I think because when you've looked at enough images as I have and taken enough, you see the thread.
Yeah.
You see the thread. You see, you know, the trans community come under attack and you're like, you're trying to tell me that 0.5% of the world, the tiny amount of trans people all over the world, are responsible for what industry leaving your seaside town? Tourism leaving, you know, automotive and the mines closing down. You're trying to tell me you're going to believe. Yeah. And if you know trans people as I do, they're 99% of the trans people I know are really vulnerable, right? And they've been through hell and back just to try and... do you know what it's like to be born into a body that is your prison? Let's call it what it is, you know? These people have been through enough. They are not the enemy, right? So
of the most beautiful placards amongst the photographs is one which says, if you're blaming immigrants... you're looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and it's by a granny that I'm trying to get in. There's so many legendary grannies. Yeah. So I look at the trans issue. I look at the ownership of the British newspapers that are attacking the trans people. We also need to look at patriarchy and why there are not women in the room in the corridors of power relative to the amount of men that have had a good crack at it.
So you were a leader and a teacher.
Yes.
An exemplar.
To bear witness.
Of right? Bearing witness.
Yes. And resistance without... Peter Margabane said, and this in my film, you know, without documentation, there's no resistance at all. You know?
In your film.
Yeah.
We'll come on to speak about your film work. But
I also think my images are there to hold your hand and say, your whisper is a roar.
Ah.
Right? So me documenting the truth of... trans humanity, of women's rights, of anti-racism, right? Mm-hmm. Of the woman life freedom movement. I have images from there. I have images from, obviously, when my life changed forever after George Floyd was lynched, right, on camera. I have a lot of the images that led me to becoming the first black man to shoot the cover of British Vogue and the September issue, which is even more of a thing in fashion. Now, I had a choice then. I could have just been vibes, right? I could have just continued shooting lots of fabulous people and going to lots of fabulous places. But the streets kept calling me, right? The roar of the streets, I couldn't ignore it. And every single protest movement that has happened since George Floyd, I've been there. You know, and which is why my body of work is quite unique, because it's everything from Grenfell to Chris Cabber to Afghanistan.
Yes.
It's all there. I've shot it all.
What you describe as the roar of the streets, I experienced like this. Walking into the exhibition and going through the rooms, I felt accompanied by the people on the walls and that I could accompany them. I want to ask you about the cultural power of Britain and Nigeria as you are living through it, experiencing it and observing it. What do you think it's doing for our culture here in Britain or in the world?
Well, in a far-right protest, I saw a great sign. I think it's in the show. It's downstairs in the show saying, we are here because you were there.
Sivanandan.
Yeah. And
the great cultural theorist. Yeah,
it's such a, I don't know why people don't use that more. It just says, I love it, you know, and.
Oh, they do. It's known. I think
It's known. And I think Nigerians are not meek, right? So we take space. We do business well. We love music, film. We are in the tip of the spear of what popular culture is today, and some of that has come directly from Lagos via London and to the world. And in sports, of course, we have superstars in rugby and football.
No, you can't be glossing over football. Nigeria is doing terribly in football.
Well, but in terms of the Nigeria-British,
oh, right,
so we have England players of Nigerian heritage. Yes. But it's also been an interesting journey because you're right, the class system comes into it. And I think you just like with South Asian brothers and sisters that we have been, you know, we come from a generation of looking up to proximity to whiteness. So that can create tricky situations like a Rishi Sunak being the first brown prime minister, but having pretty right-wing views and being able to sit and look with his whole chest at a camera and say that he doesn't believe that there's any racism in the UK.
And this is you tiptoeing around Kemi Badenoch.
I would never tiptoe around that. I have a sledgehammer ready to speak.
But
about
let's not
that.
Go for the ad hominem attacks.
No, no. And that's why I you know, wanted to preface it. We're talking about, you know, the South Asian community and the black community. And
yes,
we can end up, if we're not careful in 2025, when we're so well informed, is having this generation of black and brown voices that are only allowed to be in the corridors of power if they are, you know, caricatures, you know, yes, whether it's Priti Patel, Suella, Kemi, even Kwasi, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, you go to Peckham, mm-hmm, right? You mentioned Peckham, and you asked me if any of those people speak for the people there. Where I go, I need Amala.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, Lolak, I know the place.
Lolak, I know well. You tell me if they have posters of any of those people.
Yeah, well.
So I think we need to be really, really careful as a community to you know, realize that we bring so much to the great soup of this nation. And we shouldn't reduce ourselves or become self-hating, mm-hmm, in order to feel that that's the only way to thrive.
Is there anything that you have experienced around African culture, or let's narrow it down, around Nigerian culture, which you think is of value to the world?
Everything.
Everything.
You know.
Give us some examples. Give us some
well,
insights.
I mean, you know, starting from Fela Kuti, you know.
The great musician.
Yeah, who kept it very, very real. And he was an activist, a real activist. Now, you know, obviously you've got Burna Boy Tem, so many coming up. But more than that, I think Nigerian food is crossing over. There are more Nigerian restaurants than I've ever seen. And if you go into a niche in the West End, I mean, it's half full of like students from Asia and other parts of the world. Jollof rice is part of English culture now, you know.
Food, music.
Also, travel. There's a lot more people wanting to actually go on proper tourist trips, not just to Nigeria, but obviously Ghana is doing that job very, very well as well. And it isn't just African Americans doing the kind of right to return trips. It's actually saying, I want to go on holiday and experience the richness and diversity of these nations. So I think tourism will be a big part of it. I think consuming, you know, what is cool. So the aspiration of a genuine African experience, whether it's fashion, which we're very, you know, you know, art, obviously. My dear friend Tokuni Peterside is having the 10th anniversary this year of ArtX, you know, great art fair. So, you know, the soft power of culture can change the world.
Yes,
you
know, it can.
And I think we can be one of the leaders. Also, at least speaking for Nigeria, I think Nigeria, 70% of Nigeria is under the age of 30 as well. And again, the borderless ability of being able to connect and educate yourself through the internet, but also reach people.
Do you see any difficulties in the way that African America and, let's say, Nigeria kind of meet and talk? Can they form that bridge effectively?
Yeah, I think they can form the bridge. But I think, you know, both cultures are very different and they have to get to know each other. The source code may be the same, right?
Yes.
And genetically, obviously we are family, but the lived experience is different. So if the lived experience is different, we have to go through a great unlearning so we can hold our hands together and build a cultural footbridge, per se, that is one that will be immensely powerful.
You've so far developed your work in photography, but you are now moving further forward into film. And one of your short films, The After, was Oscar nominated, as I understand it, and that's being followed up with further projects. That is the kind of bridge, that is the kind of encounter across which African Americans and West Africans, for example, can meet each other. Can you tell me a little bit about what you hope to achieve with this further move into film?
Well, I think the intentionality of me as an artist is really important. So the story of The After is about grief, and it is a Nigerian man is a lead character, but it's a film for the world. And because I made it with Netflix, it was seen by millions and millions and millions of people. And it's, you know, this is me, a Nigerian man, telling a story with a Nigerian lead, David Oyelowo, right? Giving one of the great performances of our time, being nominated for an Academy Award for my first film, showing what happens when we get given the opportunity to tell our stories in our way. And what I love about it, apart from the film doing well, is that, you know, people from all four corners of, creation were deeply moved by it, which shows a cultural power of our stories. Because the lead character's name is Dayo, right? It's not James or Bobby. I was very intentional, and everyone soaked it all in.
Yeah, it becomes joy.
Yes, and David and I are going to have a long, we have a couple of projects that we have in development. And my new film is with another Nigerian filmmaker called Andy Mundy Castle, who won a BAFTA for his last film called White Nanny, Black Child. And this is a film called Shoot the People, and it's a feature-length documentary on my life.
Oh.
And it is an observation on what it means to be an artist that refuses to look away when it pays to be apathetic. And it's a really honest observation on protest, imagery, and what fearless artistry means in the age of fear.
The purpose of light.
Absolutely.
Miss N. Harriman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
Gabriel Badamozy was in conversation with the writer and photographer, Miss San Harriman. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.